cracking the cube, going slow to go fast, and other unexpected turns in the world of competitive Rubik's Cube solving is the new book by Ian Scheffler. He dives into the colorful world of Rubik's Cube. Invented in 1974 by the reclusive Hungarian architect Erno Rubik, the puzzle was famously popular in the 1980s. It has since come roaring back, inspiring competitions around the world, not to mention robots, movies, and Edward Snowden. As Ian Scheffler shows, this bout of cube fever is anything but nostalgia. The name again of the book is Cracking the Cube. Ian Scheffler is a competitive cuber and the author of the new book, and we welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Ian, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
What brought you to want to write this book and to take a look at this competitive world of solving the Rubik's Cube?
Well, I fell into it by accident. About 11 years ago, I went to a very unusual summer camp that Lady Gaga and Mark Zuckerberg and even Sergey Brin, the co-founder of Google, attended when they were children. And on the very first day, I happened to sit next to the greatest Rubik's Cube solver on the planet. I didn't know it at the time. I just knew he was a kid solving a Rubik's Cube under his desk without even looking at it. And he taught me how to do it. And years later, I found out that he and his brother essentially created the FIFA of Rubik's Cubes, and I wanted to write about it.
So when it comes to that idea of the FIFA of Rubik's Cube, so how does that work? Give us an idea of the guidelines, because we think of this as a puzzle. So you have a puzzle and you solve it. How do you make it more complicated than that?
Well, it's complicated enough to begin with, because every single time you solve it, it's a different experience. It's almost like if you were going to run the 100-meter dash, but you know, you do it once and there is a water pit, and you do it again and there's a flaming hoop you have to jump through, or it's a maze. And so, you know, to an outsider looking in, it might look like we're all kind of having seizures below the wrists because our hands are moving so fast. But in reality, what we're doing is essentially playing chess at the speed of ping pong. So you're right. It is basically like you're trying to solve the puzzle, but it's a lot more complicated and interesting than you might think from just a quick glance.
So give us an idea of that world, of the competitive nature of it, and what actually goes into the competitive aspect of you doing it better than me, doing it better than the person next to us.
Well, that's the question here, Joe. So have you ever had a moment in your life when you were doing sports or music or some other engrossing activity or even hosting a radio show where you were just so tuned into the moment, you were so keyed in that the time itself kind of slowed down, you're really just in the zone?
I feel like that every day, Ian.
Oh, well, look at you. You know, it's that feeling, that's the feeling you have to have. It's almost a meditative state to be able to solve a Rubik's Cube very fast to be competitive, because, and that's what the subtitle alludes to, going slow to go fast. I found this out myself at the World Championship in 2013 when I, on my last solve of the competition, because you do five solves and they average them to make sure that a lucky configuration doesn't give you a boost. I just said, you know what, I'm going to follow the advice of this one guy who said, you know, just try slowing down a bit, which seems totally counterintuitive. And it felt like the slowest solve I'd ever done. I was just really not even looking at the timer. I seemed to proceed as if my hands had been covered in molasses. And then I stopped it, and it was a personal best by 10 seconds. It was like a 33-second solve. So to get really fast at a certain point, it's not so much about your technique, although there are specific techniques we learn almost the same way jazz musicians learn scales and chords that you remix every time, because each solve is ultimately an improvisation. But it's much more about solving yourself than solving the cube. You have to get to a very special place inside.
There is a young man from Kentucky who holds the world record for the quickest single solve, 4.9 seconds. He's 14 years old. How do you do that?
Well, I'm happy to explain. That's Lucas Etter, I believe you're speaking of,
yes.
And I've met him. He, like many top cubers, what separates them all are fractions of a second. And so how fast you are depends both on how quickly you can turn the puzzle. It certainly helps to have young fingers, I suppose, but also how few moves you can solve the puzzle in, which is where this becomes like chess, because the greatest cubers can look ahead and they can picture the moves they need to do the same way a grandmaster like Magnus Carlsen can picture, you know, 10 moves ahead what his opponent is going to do. So before you solve it, you're actually allowed to inspect the cube for 15 seconds, and a great cuber like Lucas can start planning out what he's going to do, and then he can get to that place. It's almost solving a Rubik's Cube at that speed, and my best solve is about 12 seconds for comparison. It's almost like that scene in the movie The Matrix where Neo is moving so fast that everything else is slow. Do you remember that scene?
Yes.
Yeah, so you're so keyed in that time itself dilates. It's a very heady experience, almost like a runner's high, which is one reason that we're all so engrossed in this, because the faster you get, the more used to it you get, and you have to keep getting faster to get that feeling again. So, I could give a sort of more mathematical explanation for what Lucas is doing, but it's almost as much a spiritual quest as a mathematical one.
43.2 quintillion possible permutations for the cube. Here's a question that I've long wondered, and I don't even know how exactly to ask it, but how do you know when the cube is properly mixed up, meaning that it's ready for you to solve?
So that's a very good question, because obviously how fair the competitions are depends on everyone having an equal shot at a good solution. So of those 43 quintillion solutions, the vast majority require between 17 and 19 moves to solve optimally. And, only an omniscient being or a human being given a lot of time and computer power could really come up with one of those. I mean, it takes most of us about 50 to 60 moves on average. And so there's a computer program that the organization uses called T-Noodle, which is named after the noodle joint in Berkeley, California, where it was first written, the computer program, that is. And each cube is scrambled randomly. But the thing is, each cube is given the same random scramble. So there's actually an international language of Rubik's Cube devised by a British mathematician, which allows someone in Mongolia to say, compare times with me on the internet, because we can, post a scramble, as it's called. In competition, these are induced by the scramblers, who off in the corner where you can't see them, they mix your puzzle up, and they make sure everyone's puzzle's mixed up the same way. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, yes. So you're all basically starting from the same point, then.
Exactly, the same random starting point.
Tell me a little bit about Erno Rubik. You talk about this in the book, but obviously he's very reclusive, and this is somebody you wanted to meet. You did end up talking to him for the book.
Yeah, I like to think of Erno as sort of like the Willy Wonka of Eastern Europe. He's extremely sophisticated, incredibly creative. He invented the world's most successful puzzle. He's got a background in everything from sculpture to architecture, and his influences range from Da Vinci to Isaac Asimov, the science fiction writer. Like I say in the book, he's a fairly reclusive figure. After the rise and fall of the cube in the 80s, he more or less retreated to his native Hungary, where he turned down virtually all media requests, and many requests certainly found him. It took me about 2 years to get a one-hour lunchtime interview, which I have to say was one of the most surreal experiences of not only this whole process, but of my life.
So in that time, what did you learn? Because I assume you're obviously working on it for the purposes of the book and telling the story, but there also just has to be a lot of personal curiosity that you're interested in as well.
Well, you've honed in on the crux of the matter. It was a bit of a strange experience because I simultaneously had this imperative to take notes, to ask him questions, to bring back something not only for the speed cubing community, but for the public and for the book, something that would be interesting. And yet I so badly wanted to just sit there and have lunch with him, because who gets to have lunch with Erno Rubik? That's a pretty rare treat. So we talked about a lot of things. I mean, I think it will certainly surprise readers of the book who are involved in cubing and those who are not, how up to date on just about everything he is. He winds up going on a sort of entering into a philosophical discussion about the nature of sports themselves and how solving a Rubik's Cube does and doesn't fit into that.
Did this make him a wealthy man?
Yes. So Erno Rubik is certainly wealthy. One of his close associates told me that back in the 1980s, Mr. Rubik could easily have purchased perhaps half of the entire nation of Hungary, because he had so much more foreign currency than anybody else around, whole tracts of land and factories and that sort of thing. But the thing about Mr. Rubik is he's extremely modest, and that's not the sort of thing he would enjoy doing. So he certainly lives comfortably, but he's hardly ostentatious about his wealth. And, it's certainly not why he invented the puzzle in the first place.
Right. When it comes to this idea of competitive cubing, do you know what his record is?
Yes, actually. So Mr. Rubik for many years was the only person alive who could solve the Rubik's Cube. And just for the record, he actually calls it his cube because it's technically a possessive, which is sort of funny when you meet him. He says, this is my cube, you know, the same way, I might say this is, my bottle of water or something. So he had to learn to solve it. Initially, he didn't know if it even could be solved. He invented it more or less by accident. But he can solve it at his best, he said, at about a minute. And he never really tried to get faster than that because his only goal was to demonstrate that it could be solved.
And does he still look at this as one of his great achievements, or does he look at it as something that is just one of many and kind of the silly one that got through and became perhaps more important than it should have?
Well, I think that's a question he himself is still in some ways struggling to answer. One of the quotes I found in a very old publication related to him says that he's quoted as saying that, you know, success is a whole other puzzle and it's much less easy to untangle than his own cube, and his own cube is hard enough. I don't think he certainly never expected, I know this, he certainly never expected the cube to be as big as it was. I mean, there's some varying stories. He's a bit like his own puzzle in that the sides don't always line up. But the basic idea is he was living with his mother in communist Hungary in the 1970s when he invented this by accident. And, you know, who would ever expect that a wooden toy from behind the Iron Curtain would travel the world? So it certainly took him by surprise. And it's, I think, much to his surprise and delight that the cube has made a comeback.
Okay, my last question, which is maybe weird, but I'm just curious. How many cubes do you go through? Do you need new ones? Do you go through them so that you need new ones regularly?
Yes. Well, it's almost a bit like a technological war where there's constantly models of so-called speed cubes coming out that are progressively faster and easier to solve. And so the speed cubing community, keeps purchasing them and upgrading in almost the same way that people do with computers or with cars or with iPhones. So at this point, I think I've got about a dozen, ranging from a vintage Rubik's Cube from the 80s, which was given to me by a friend on the condition I never open it, so it's still in the box. And then one of the latest, which is actually a boutique puzzle named after one of the greatest solvers on the planet, because it's evolved to the point where there's even sponsored cubers whose jerseys resemble those of NASCAR drivers.
Well, it's all fascinating, and it's a really neat world. The book is Cracking the Cube, Going Slow to Go Fast, and Other Unexpected Turns in the World of Competitive Rubik's Cube Solving. The book is published by Touchstone. Ian Scheffler, thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe.
Again, the name of the book, Cracking the Cube, published by Touchstone. Ian Scheffler is the author of the book. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.